We've seen so many endeavors over the past 15 to 20 years where people come out with the idea that if I only get bazillions of people to follow me, eventually I'll figure out some way to turn that into profit.
There's also the other side where the businesses are just maximizing profit and they have no interest in providing good customer experience.
From Orion X, this is the Marketing Podcast. Marketing has transformed in significant ways. More technology, more data, more social, more blending of arts and sciences, more integrated with every other function, and ultimately more critical to the organization. Join Shaheen Khan and Doug Garnett as they discuss news and happenings in the world of marketing, from the boardroom to customer programs.
Hi, everybody. Marketing Podcast here again, episode number 40. This is Shaheen Khan with Doug Garnett. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. Excellent. Delighted to be here. And thanks for the pre-show call, which, as usual, you all know, we spend like 2, sometimes 3 hours chatting about things. So it's a joy for me to catch up with Doug.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have a cartoon of the week.
Yes, the tune of the week has a guy dressed like a Pied Piper, and he's got some sort of, well, it looks clarinet-ish or recorder-ish or something in his hand. And there's this pile of mice or rats stretching out behind him around the corner and way down an aisle. There's just millions of them. And he's talking to a guy, and he says, okay, now I just need to convert them into paid subscribers. There you go. So the Pied Piper, he just has to get those rats to become paid subscribers and he's set for life.
Conversion.
It's all about conversion. What's your conversion rate? How are you converting?
So he clearly doesn't have a top of the funnel problem, but he does have a point of sale problem.
I think that's the message here. Yeah, I think that's the message. Top of the funnel's fine. The conversion problem, well, it's like he probably has to figure out something they're going to pay for. But
that's right. It's hard to tell what exactly he's selling.
Besides, yeah, that's true. Hey, dude, I like the tunes. So
but the other thing it reminded me of was just the idea of leaving the hard parts for later, like kicking the can on the hard parts. And yeah. Of course, when you look at a sales funnel, that's kind of what you're doing. You're saying, mm-hmm. let me just reel them in and then I'll see if I can convert them and I'll go through stages. So there's definitely the sales funnel analogy was strong in that one.
Well, I think for me too, as I look at this, we've seen so many endeavors over the past 15 to 20 years where people come out with the idea that if I only get bazillions of people to follow me, eventually I'll figure out some way to turn that into profit. And I think for a specific example, I think about Pinterest, right? Pinterest came out. It's a visual site for social media. A lot of artists use it. A lot of designers use it. And it's used to kind of track photos and visuals and keep organized and really valuable. A great service for all those people. It's something that was really productive. On the other hand, they're not going to pay for it. And so they can't charge for subscribers. So Pinterest comes out, develops all these people using their software. And then the people who helped them get started said, great, now we need profit. And they're struggling. It's really hard to turn a whole bunch of rats following you, if I'm a rat, into profit. But we've had about 15 or 20 years where that would seem to be the assumption of a fair number of investors is, oh, if you just get a lot of people involved, there'll be profit there somehow. And truth is, some people do figure it out. Some people turn that model into a lot of profit. Facebook, Meta did. But what we don't see is how many didn't turn it into profit.
That's right. That's right. Well, we've talked about it on this podcast. There are a whole bunch of jokes, starting with a million people walk into a bar and nobody orders a drink.
Right.
And then their variations, they're saying, we're just here for the Wi-Fi password.
Right.
Or is this some kind of a sober revolution? And then there is one that says a million people walk into a Silicon Valley bar and nobody orders a thing and the bartender becomes like a billionaire or something. So this is very much along those lines that once you have that many people in the tent, your valuation goes up because there's an expectation that one way or another, you're going to monetize this.
Come back to your thought about how you're kicking the hard stuff down the road, which is how am I going to make profit with this? And there's reasons to sometimes kick the hard stuff down the road. On the other hand, when it's the primary way people do business, which is let's ignore the hard stuff and let's just get a lot of people involved with soft things, it's not a successful way to do business. And you cannot kick hard stuff down the road forever. At some point, you have to think, what am I going to do here? I once worked with an infomercial campaign that was supposed to get people to call and buy the product. And I was just doing the research around it and knew from our research that it was a bust and why it was a bust. And so our creative team came back and said, well, instead of trying to sell the product, how about we give away stickers? And it was amazing how many people wanted stickers. They still didn't get any sales, but they were able to give away millions of stickers if they had wanted to. And the client shut the whole thing down because they actually needed profit and revenue and customers and things like that.
Yeah, I think it's a really good seed for something that we're going to talk about later in this podcast with complexity. But the other topic we were talking about was quality of service.
Yeah.
And the customer experience in the parlance of marketing and whether there was a difference between public or private organizations offering such service and the assumptions that are ingrained in many. And none other than Rory Sutherland had a paper that you sent to me. So let's talk a little bit about that. What is he saying again?
Yeah, so if Rory Sutherland, he publishes a weekly column in The Spectator. And this week's column I pulled out because I thought it was so on topic and so wrapped up in what we do in marketing. And essentially, he writes that modern technology, he suggests, makes it all too easy for companies to treat their customers with high-handed disdain and bureaucratic inflexibility, and suggests that these private companies are just as inflexible as any state enterprise. And of course, we all love to blame the state enterprises for inflexibility. Shaheen, and you and I've talked about it, and we don't necessarily agree that it's all technology's fault, but I do agree that this is happening now, regardless of how we got there. A lot of companies are treating their customers very badly. He goes on and says, until this century, most transactions were conducted face-to-face. Such transactions are lubricated by a high degree of tacit trust and shame avoidance. By contrast, any online exchange has to be designed to proof against the world's most dishonest people. And that imposes a huge burden on the majority of honest customers. And I could not agree more. I hate calling in to somebody for customer service and feel like they are trying to suss out whether you're a crook or not. There's no assumption that the person on the other end of the line is honest, trustworthy, until trust but verify approach. It's a distrust. Maybe you'll earn their trust later. And it is bad. Just for his conclusion, he says the most telling statistic in the UK is that 1 in 4 customers had felt truly enraged by a recent experience. 1 in 6 was enraged in at least 5 areas of their life. Oh boy, that's not good. None of this is good. None of this is good for companies.
Yeah. So my immediate reaction was that, well, first of all, excellent observation. And there's truth everywhere on what he's saying. But this also assumes that the businesses are coming at it from some kind of a pure heart. And they're just trying to cover for the risks that are reasonable to accommodate. There's also the other side where the businesses are just maximizing profit and they have no interest in providing good customer experience, or they look around and their competition, which is not many, are also not providing it. So then they feel like they can get away with it. And unlike a public service where customer has a recourse and there are checks and balances, and like the reason why there's a bureaucracy is because all of those are there. In a private enterprise, they're not accountable. And unless there's a regulation specifically about that topic that is somehow enforced, they can just like not be responsive, right?
They can get away with a lot.
Yeah. So to my immediate reaction was that you really, I mean, this whole private enterprise in principle works when there is sufficient competition. At one end, you have perfect competition, and that's kind of the basis for laissez-faire economics and capitalism. At the other end, you've got a monopoly. But in the economics classes, there was another category called oligopoly, when it's not a monopoly, but it's few enough that it's still kind of not exactly efficient. And I feel that's the problem.
Well, I mean, in our pre-show, I mean, I think we covered about 45 different topics out of this one starting point. But I think that's one of them. I mean, in that we talked about there really has been a decrease in competition in the market in a lot of areas. For example, my area of tools, whereas every one of the brands used to make their own tools, now most of the brands buy their tools from the same Chinese manufacturers. There may be 3 or 4 of them, and they're very good. The quality of the tools is exceptional, but the variety of the marketplace has just crashed. I mean, one of those Chinese companies was one of my customers, and they would simultaneously be pitching tools to Sears, Lowe's, and Home Depot all at once. And that was just that's just the way you do business is that. And so we have had a tremendous reduction in competition. And I think especially as you and I were talking, I still think that we very often think that competition only means price. But in reality, in the marketplace, competition is on everything. Trustworthiness, quality, satisfaction. It's a whole robust set of things. One of the dangers I feel from the last 40 years of development in the U.S. is that we've come to isolate on price. And I don't know quite why, but price has taken over as the dominant element of competition. And that's bad for us all.
Because it's easy to measure, right?
Well, yeah, it probably is. It's because it's easy to measure. I know that the antitrust law now focuses on low price because the legal system needs something that's measurable to be able to judge things on. And so a market is unhealthy if there aren't low prices everywhere, which you and I were talking about. I think the exact opposite, that a healthy market has a wide range of prices, and that's what makes it interesting, and that's what makes it healthy, because mm-hmm. then companies have incentive to make new things that satisfy people.
But like you also were saying, there's also the question of competition across the supply chain.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like if mm-hmm. you want to buy a Chevy, you can go test out different dealerships, but you can also go buy a Ford. You can also go buy a Chrysler. You can go, right? So you have uh-huh. competition across the supply chain, and that mm-hmm. is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you're buying the same appliance or the same tool that is just differently labeled.
Yeah.
So you have competition in the customer-facing phase of the supply chain, but not upstream.
Yeah. And I think that's part of what it does allow companies to get away with this in a sense, because if your product is the same as everybody else's and your customer is upset about it and nobody provides good customer service on it, why should you go out of your way to try to provide good customer service on it? And certainly an argument could be made that if you're the one that provides good customer service, you'll get more people. I don't know how often that will pay off. I know that there's research that Ehrenberg Bass has done, which indicates that customer satisfaction ratings don't have a really strong connection to future purchases. You know,
right.
They're satisfied, but if you spend a bunch of money going to make people satisfied, are you going to make yourself rich? Not necessarily. I don't think the answer is no, but I think you have to be wise and smart and savvy about it. So yeah, Rory's solution is this is a case where he suggested as a conservative that this is a place where it seems like it's gotten so bad that the government needs to step in. So how bad? Here's one. I've been trying. We have three accounts that have all of our cell phones on it in my household, and we've been trying to bring them all together into one account. And I've been trying to do that for 8 months and have probably spent 5 hours on the phone attempting to get it to happen. So finally, I realized that this is only going to happen well if they have something printed in front of them that says these numbers, these accounts combine, make one, all that stuff. And so I talked to him, talking to an agent, said, well, where can I send that? She said, there is no way to send them. There's no place, AT&T, I could send instructions that say, this is a complicated thing. I need you to help me with it. And that they would do it. Just shit out of luck on that one. And you think, how can it be that bad? But it's been that bad. And I've gone through a wide range of different customer service operations in AT&T, but none of them can take anything written.
Yeah. And then you've got some of these new internet services where there's not even a person.
Right. Yes.
It's mm-hmm. the only thing you can do is chat with a robot or send an email mm-hmm. and hope somebody reads it. And many of those email addresses aren't set up for incoming email anyway. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine that if you're like an elderly customer, that can be very difficult, right?
Yeah. Well, I think so. And actually, because that does raise the issue that as companies pursue all these hot online methods, they're also punishing the people who are not online savvy. And I think that grows as you get to older populations. There's more and more people that are not online savvy, but I know of people in their 20s that aren't that online savvy. So you kind of end up punishing groups of customers and creating dissatisfaction amongst certain groups. And for the moment, they're getting away with it and they're showing profits. But I just think you got to think it's going to come back to haunt people at some point.
So there's another angle. We've talked about competition and then regulation. I think there's a third element, and that's social norms. It's hard for me to go down any of these examples of customer quality, trust, service, etc. All the nostalgic views that people say in the old days, it was like this. without coming to social norms, that there's no way to really operate in society by trying to make sure every possible deviation from niceness, goodness is covered by some law,
right?
Or some kind of, right? So at some point, the society needs to say, you know what? Let's not cheat this way. Let's not do this bad thing anymore, right?
Let me give you an example from Oregon. In Oregon, we have full service gas. So with the exception of the smallest of communities, anywhere you go in Oregon, you go to a gas station and they pump it. What I've been struck by is the number of people that will comment around it and complain. They don't live here. They're people from out of state and they complain. Isn't it terrible to have the government prevent you from pumping your gas? And my response is, it's the last elegant customer service in the world. I mean, I love sitting in my car while a guy fills it, and I appreciate it. I think it's great. I'm always kind to them because it matters. And you think about it, some point in the U.S., we made a compromise that said that little bit of service, people are not worth it. And so we made a compromise. And as we make those compromises socially, it becomes more and more acceptable to treat people badly. So the compromise in tech to having nobody you can talk to started 20 years ago and has grown. And never have we as a society thrown a fit and said, that's not working for us.
Well, in Oregon's case, it's also helpful for folks who really cannot be near actual gasoline.
Yeah.
They have allergies or sensitivities, etc. And there are some states where they do both, you know, self-service here, full service there. But I kind of don't mind the Oregon way. I mean, I lived there and it was fine.
It's never bothered me. Mostly when I go out of state, I'm like, oh, drat, I got to pump my own gas.
Well, occasionally you have to wait and you say, gosh, I could just have done it by now already.
Well, but that gets back into, is efficiency everything? I think we have to, at some point, we've become an efficiency-worshipping society, and that's bad for us. Culturally, efficiency can't be the only thing that matters, because if efficiency is all that matters, we stop living good lives and having good friendships and having satisfaction. Efficiency is one-dimensional. It's not really that much fun.
And too much of it can be really detrimental for your health.
It really can. The race to the bottom is driven by efficiency, and that leads to poor products. And let's look at places we've found that. Those cartoons that show people in the 50s getting served meals on the airplanes, and they're saying, God, just imagine what service is going to be like in 40 years. And the reality is now you're lucky if they throw cookies at you.
That's
you
right.
Enter the a package of cookies as you enter the airplane. Well, there has been an erosion there. And I don't know if it's some of it's valid, probably. Some of it's not. Some of it's just change. But I think companies get away with a lot they shouldn't get away with.
Yeah. So the other thing we talked about, change of topic, because it came up in this conversation, was the alignment between marketing and finance. Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked about this. We had a meetup with Alistair Thompson a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Look him up on Twitter if you don't already. His handle is at Finance Director CFO, DIR. And he's written a couple of books on this sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. We've talked about how to get alignment. So let's chat about that a little bit.
I think it's great. I think it follows up effectively on this question of what's going on with self-checkout and with self-service and with basically fundamental service. Because I think within companies, we're at a point where you can always win an argument by saying, well, let's cut cost. It's a lot easier to cut cost than to argue for let's build a better service or let's change this. It's really easy to say, well, we'll just cut cost. And the AI guys, I think, are going to make bank by doing that. And that's going to be the argument, so we can cut cost. But when you sit back and really look at it, it does come back to finance. And I think we work under a lot of misperceptions in marketing. And one of the marketing misperceptions is finance is our enemy. And I don't know entirely why they were at that point. I do know that there is plenty of evidence that the people going into marketing these days, there's a number, and I don't know what the percentage is, that choose marketing in order to avoid numbers. I was once interviewed about advertising by a sociologist, and she called up and I said, yeah, I have a mathematics, a master's in mathematics. And she's like, she was stunned and appalled. She says, you don't know how many people I've talked to that intentionally chose advertising to stay away from numbers. And I think that could lead to an intimidation that I don't want to go talk with finance because numbers scare me and I have a phobia about them. But however it happens, I think people in marketing are afraid.
Yeah. Now, this came up because you shared a case study where a CMO comes to the agency and agency he's been working with for years, but he's like relatively new. So tell us that story.
Yeah, so the story is that CMO has just been hired by the company, and he comes to the agency, my agency, so it's personal, comes to my agency and says, oh, you've been doing this work for years. We've done really well. We're making millions of dollars. We're selling millions of units of product. It's all great. It's all great. So therefore, we want to do an agency review and open it up for competitive bids. And I'm appalled because what happens with that, and I know that check out the people you're working with to make sure you want to keep working with them is something we do all the time. But to make it this idea of a competition when you've got an agency that has well served your company for 4 years, I was offended that they even raised the question. I mean, had they gone out for review, I probably would not have responded in the review.
Yeah.
Because that was such bad form. It showed the company to be entirely untrustworthy, to my mind. Because when you're working with somebody, trust is a tremendous part of getting really good stuff from them.
Now, you were saying he did that because the CEO, who had a finance background, had asked him to.
Yep. So the CMO did this because the CEO came to him and said, we need to do a competition because I'm a finance guy and you always put everything out to bid every 2 or 3 years just because you should. And that CEO idea powered without an understanding of human beings. And Deming advised against this in his statistician's way that, look, you cannot be doing this to people because trust brings a lot of monetary value to you as a company.
Yeah. So for me, this is where the whole marketing finance alignment became, that flag was raised. Because my view was that if the CMO had their wits about them, they would have explained the situation to the CFO, CEO. They say, here's what we're trying to do. Here's why we're trying to do it. Here's what else we've looked at. Here's why whatever it is that you want is already being handled. We already have the low cost, highest quality agency in place. And that then brought up, how do you go get that alignment with finance? And my view has been, as you can go 2-3 years ago with the meetup that we had with Alistair, was that you have to, A, consider finance a partner. They're not another division that just approves your budget request, but they're a partner. They add value. In fact, I get some of the best feedback on marketing content from the finance department. They have a different perspective. They see things that other people didn't see. And my job as a CMO is to bring the best of whatever I can. So why not use that? You have to explain. You have to respect. You have to understand. And like you said, marketing is finance because at the end, it's all about revenue. It's all about margin, about valuation, about multiple. These are all financial metrics, right?
Well, I think the most important thing that Alistair said was that as a CFO, he loves marketing because he wants revenue to manage. And if he doesn't have any revenue to manage, he's in trouble and his job sucks. I mean, basically, that's it. If the CFO doesn't have money to manage, what a miserable job. And I think there's a real truth to that. I was telling you, my experience is I spent a little bit of time as the guy who had to go get deals approved at the company Shaheen and I were at. And so I was going to go up and work with this finance guy and all the salespeople like, oh, watch out for him. Oh my God. Oh, he's horrible, horrible, horrible. When I started working with him, he was great. He wanted to help make things happen, to do good things for the company. He also knew the hard truths about what stuff cost and that we couldn't approve a deal if there weren't the right kinds of margins around it. And I ended up loving working with him and found great times hanging out in his office while we try to sort out deals and figure out how to make things work. And I think with your comments about what you've been doing lately, it's the how do you work with finance to make things happen is what you want to do. And maybe that's part of the marketing fear is a lot of marketers just throw a budget request over the wall. And then finance comes back and not understanding all the details or whatever, just comes back and says, no, cut it all by 30%. And now you've got a standoff between marketing and finance. And that doesn't help.
No, it has to be a partnership. And a lot of it has to do with mutual explanation and et cetera. But if you do that, then you really are aligned and life is really very good because now everybody knows why you're doing what you're doing. You're holding back for this reason. You're investing for that reason. You've got metrics here. You're doing an experiment there. They're all good with all of that. Mm-hmm. As long as you've put the effort in to keep everybody up to date.
Maybe we should shift into our next topic because I have an idea that directly links it into the finance marketing communication.
It's a great time to do that.
What we wanted to talk about next is I saw that podcast with a guy named Ian McGilchrist, who's a psychiatrist. If you don't know of him, he wrote the book, The Master and His Emissary, and has done some very thought-provoking medical work on how the mind works. And I really like what he writes about, talks about. Well, he is complexity-based, fundamentally. And so in this podcast, he observed at school, already thought that the whole is not the same as the sum of the parts. And that if you break it down into parts, something is taken out by disassembling the whole. And I thought that was really interesting. And specifically, how does that relate to marketing and finance? Budgets. In my book, I've been writing about budgets are a reduction. Budgets, when you look at numbers in a budget, you're not seeing the whole that the budget's intended to produce. You're not seeing the connections between the categories of spending that cause this budget to produce good results. All you're seeing is numbers. And so what ends up happening is budgets by themselves become seen as a disembodied thing because they're missing whatever it is that happens between the parts. I mean, just for a last thought, and then I'll look for your thoughts on it, is that McGilchrist went on and said to imagine a poem and that there's only so many things people are going to write poems about. The tragedy of love, the awareness of morality, what are their 5 or 6 topics, and that's about it. And if you do the process of just analyzing the poem, you come up with a handful of dust. Because attempting to analyze the poem destroys the things that might deeply move your soul. And I think it's that challenge we face, which is what we're trying to do, in our case, is move the market. But reductions end up losing the connective tissue that would help finance understand what it is we're trying to do and how they relate.
Yeah, it's awesome. And there's a lot to comment on that. But I want to try to relate it to marketing. And where I see an applicability to this is attribution. What did move the needle by how much? And if you have a complex sale and you've touched the customer 5, 6, 10, 20 times, what was the impact of each, if any? That, of course, is a perennial problem. It's exactly what makes it difficult to understand the ROI of a particular element of a marketing mix and a marketing mix as a whole and the campaign as a whole. And one day we will get the clarity that perhaps some people have, but I kind of don't think so.
I see. I don't think we will ever get the clarity because I think at some level, success is the result of many things, like 20, 30, 40 things. And if you take any one of the things away, success will be less. And so you'll never be able to say that, well, A contributed this much and B contributed that much, because then you have to look at all the cases of, well, what if we did all these, but with only 39 things instead of 40? Well, it's less. Well, how much less? Well, we don't know, because it's the interrelations and the interconnections that create the potency of the whole. And I think one of the reasons that companies love reducing things into parts so much is that it gives them a sense of control. They feel like they control it, but also the parts are measurable, whereas the stuff in between the parts, whatever that mystery in a poem, whatever that mysterious thing is that moves a soul, isn't measurable. You can't go in and analyze the sentences to say, well, because the verb was preceded by, well, now we know why the poem works. Doesn't happen in a poem, and it doesn't happen in marketing. If you've got 8 touches, how can you say that losing one touch would have this impact? We don't know what that impact is. It would be less. But what?
Well, we've talked about poetry on this podcast too, right? I think we now forget the context there, but it may have been Fiona Tribe's tweet.
I think so.
That led us to talk about poetry. And I think a lot of marketing is poetry and positioning is poetry. And I think it's the flip side of what you're saying. I think that while if you're trying to solve a complex problem, breaking it apart could lose something in the process. Likewise, when you have multiple elements and you synthesize them together into a single whole, you are missing some things and some magic dust needs to be added to it for it to really resonate the way it does. And it needs to be interpretable in 2 or 3 different ways. The nuances need to be there for it to be rich rather than just kind of clinical and lifeless. So I think there's definitely that. And there's a mathematical way you can describe this. The word that comes to my mind, you're a math guy, so it's like an orthogonal vector space. If you're breaking something apart and you've really got the X, Y, and Z axes like we normally do, then maybe you're not losing anything. But if your axes are not exactly orthogonal, you are going to be missing something because you're projecting a value into an axis that covers some of it, but not all of it.
Yeah.
And then the flip side also works. So that's like really interesting. Yeah.
Well, I fully agree. It's funny because that's kind of a lot of my mathematician's intuition that goes into the complexity. And the idea of reducing space is really fundamental in math. And you know that not all reductions can be reversed, you know.
That's
right. And
I think
that's kind of it. That when we take things apart, the theory is we take them apart, we solve each one, then we bring them all together and voila. We've solved the whole thing. The best example I'm using right now is with forests. If you cut down every tree in a forest because you harvested it, and then you come back in and replant all the trees you like, which is Douglas fir up here in the Northwest, you don't regenerate a forest. You get a tree farm. And because it's lacking all the stuff. What stuff? Suzanne Simard has discovered there's funguses that grow underground that connect trees, and the trees send of different breed and different species, and that the trees send stuff back and forth through those fungus networks. And without those, you no longer really have a forest. You have a tree farm, and people do that all the time. Companies have
done
years up in the Northwest.
That's a pretty powerful analogy example. Mm-hmm. The other thing you mentioned that I think is very interesting is that when you do break it apart, the pieces that you broke apart lend themselves to metrology, measurements, metrics better. But then because you're trying to put it back together to get the original thing, the metrics aren't giving you the insight that you need because the stuff you took out was not measurable or measured.
Yeah, you lose a way to even to talk about that stuff. In fact, you and I have talked a bit about once measures exist, people tend to talk all about the numbers. And we fail to spend the time to talk about the fuzzy stuff in between. But we need to talk about it in order to understand what's going on. And yeah, bringing it back together, then we've lost that and it no longer comes together as a whole. To be clear, my sense is every business can only succeed through the complex, through things coming together. But within our business, there are some things that you could just take it apart and we'll deal with the parts and then bring them back together. But if you try to do that with something where that doesn't work, you're generally leading yourself into trouble.
That's right. That's right. I think it's true that if anytime you feel you need to break something up into pieces to put your arms around it is when you need to be careful. But if you are putting things back together, then you might be okay unless you're trying to do positioning or something that wants to have that complexity.
Absolutely. I agree with that. So shall we turn to movie complexity just for a fun one to end up with here?
Let's do it.
All right. Well, if everybody knows, well, we're recording this, of course, a couple of weeks before you're going to hear it, but we're on the cusp of Dune 2 hitting the theaters. And I was intrigued by an article I saw on Forbes that notes that Dune Part 2 sandworm popcorn buckets at AMC could be their new Barbie boost. Of course, I had to go to this article immediately to try to figure out what a sandworm popcorn bucket would look like. And if you find this, it's on Forbes, and they'll show you what the sandworm popcorn bucket looks like. And I just thought it was quite quirky because I'd never thought about making a bucket look like a sandworm. I gotta tell you, that was never on my list of things I wanted to do in life.
All right. Well, with that, we will conclude this episode. Thank you, Doug. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Shaheen.
All right. Take care. See you next time.
All right. Bye.
That's it for this episode of the Marketing Podcast. Every episode is posted on orionx.net and shared on social media. Use the comments section or tweet us with any questions or to propose topics. If you like the show, rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. The Marketing Podcast is a production of OrionX. Thank you for listening.